Yeah, in fact, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here. I had been already a year and a half in the US and still not been on this side of the country. It's really amazing. I think I was missing something. So I was so happy this weekend seeing the sun. Yeah, it's really nice. Okay, so I'm going to present today some work mostly based on these two papers that came out last year. One is in collaboration with Marcus Berg and Stefan Jörs, and the other in collaboration with Raphael Plau, William McAllister, Alexander Westphal, and Gang Xu. So a few of the authors are in the audience. And yeah, let's see what... So this is the outline. I will start... That's not there. I'll start with some motivations and then present an idea to get large field models of inflation in string theory and present a possible way to embed this one in string theory. Then I will present another way to embed the same idea into string theory, and then I will come to the conclusions. So let me start with some motivations. So it is not hard to convince people that we are living in the golden age of observational cosmology, in the sense that we have so many precise data that we can relate to the early universe. I mean, for once, Cobbick a few years ago went to Stockholm to get the Nobel Prize. The experiment, WMAP, measured basically most of the things that you can ask about the CMB are measured to the percent level by WMAP. And now the new toy in the sky is Planck, which was launched last year in May. And now on February 14th, it finished the first full sky map. So that's pretty exciting. So it could still blow up and we would have the data. This is where it was launched, and this is the guy orbitating. So it's still an exciting moment to do cosmology. So what is the picture emerging from the data? This picture has something to do, arguably, with a theory whose main parameter is unknown by at least 10 over the resolved magnitude, and nevertheless, the prediction of the theory are compatible. So no matter how you scrub with this 10 order of magnitude, you get the same, you can get the same prediction. So of course I'm talking...
On log scale?
Exactly. So there are no strong difference when we vary this parameter. This, in certain sense, says in which sense we are testing this theory. We are testing it in the indirect way through the perturbation that it produces.
You're referring to the overall scale.
And the overall scale of inflation, not to epsilon or
right?
Yeah, but I think it's a fair statement. And I mean, it's amazing that it gives the same result. I mean, I was really surprised. I don't think there are many other models such that the main the scale at which it took place is unknown by 10 order of magnitude, and still you get.
I think quantum gravity becoming strong is such an example, right? Large extra dimensions is TeV.
Mm-hmm.
String theory is only 10 to the 18 GeV. Gravity could become strong anywhere between, and we don't know.
Yeah, but this is giving something that you might measure in an experiment. Yeah, so that's enough. So inflation was thought to address the horizon and flatness and monopoles problem, for example. It arguably elevates this problem, but it probably doesn't solve it from in terms of first principle, in the sense that there is still some initial condition problem, and one can argue whether it is a bigger or a smaller problem than the one that one had before. Before inflation, but what surely inflation does is that it is a spectacular model to generate cosmological perturbations, in a sense that it very nicely agrees with what we see in the CMB data, in the sense that the simplest model of inflation, the first one that you would write down just to do the simple computation, are a small scale invariant but slightly red tilted, and they are Gaussian and they are adiabatic, and all these features has been tested more or less to the percent level. So it seems that even if this broad prediction and in very good agreement with experiments. And so yeah, now the question is, well, what is left to do? Do we stick with the simplest model of inflation? In which direction can we proceed? And I think that there are at least two kind of distinct way of going farther. One is precision measurement. As we said, we have measured all these things more or less to the percent level, Gaussianity, adiabaticity, the tilt, the running, etc. We can simply go farther, go to the next digit. We know that we have experiment doing this. And one can more quantitatively test these predictions. And we'll still the simplest model of inflation will still be compatible with experiment or not when we go to this high precision. So this is kind of one direction that one can try to evolve it. And then, I mean, there is a lot of work to do for this. For example, Leonardo mentioned a lot about non-Gaussianities, and there are many other observables that you can try to look for in the data that so far have just an upper bound.
When the simple
roll
inflation, what do you mean?
I mean slow roll, single field, canonically normalized inflation. Yeah, with simple, I mean most naive, in the sense, if you want to to do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, you probably start with even a free m-square, phi-square, eventually. Yeah, I will specify. I mean, some of the statements here are a bit general. I will try to specify as we go along. And another direction that one can do some work is to really ask questions about the theoretical soundness of this simplest model, which is, at this level, is just an effective model. In a sense, well, there are questions about the initial conditions, questions about the naturalness of inflations, questions about the approach that we use to study it. So within an effective theory approach to inflation, we can ask questions about fine-tuning the possible presence of symmetry to ensure the flatness of the potential. And one can ask, how does this approach compare to an approach within a fundamental theory, in which one asks again about symmetries, the flatness of the potential enough e-foldings, but within a theory in which there are many more constraints. For example, a theory like string theory, in which you're not able to assume that the symmetry is there and it is a symmetry of nature, but you have to go and check whether the symmetry is broken at a certain scale. So if you want the effective field theory approach, it can only assume something about the cutoff and cannot just calculate or not potentially calculate it. So these are kind of two possible ways that one could go on. And then one also could ask if there is a non-trivial correlation between observable. From putting more constraints on the theoretical construction of the model, one could get some correlation. Yes,
isn't that actually the place where the word prediction would be appropriate rather than earlier? Meaning that inflation, when people say it predicts all these things, you may actually make a model that's compatible with the observation.
Yes.
Because if I change the potential a bit, I might produce things that I don't want to, that will be incompatible with observation.
Yes, okay.
So you still have to build something that actually produces the things that you want to see, that you want to get at.
Okay, maybe the word prediction is a bit trickier, especially in cosmology when we are talking about observations, etc. So I agree. I'm saying that it is the simplest model with the fewest amount of parameters.
That's right. But in the end, are there things of the last type indeed where one would have correlations between observed?
Yes, I'm going to present a model in which, for example, these things arise.
And then you could call those predictions.
Those predictions, yes.
In his simplest model, a tensor to scalar ratio, I mean, is predicted given some other data. So there's a prediction in m squared, phi squared. Mm-hmm. It's probably wrong, but there's a prediction.
Yes, and also there is a prediction for non-Gaussianity to be small. I mean, then the question is, which prediction can you actually test? I mean, in principle, there are several predictions.
Well, isn't it maybe better to call that engineering? Okay, you want to have a model predicts what you ask your engineering in that way.
Yes, I would.
Usually, have something else in addition, right?
Yes.
In addition to things that you constructed it for, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I will try to highlight some of this of these possibilities.
No, let me be devil's advocate here. Because on Wednesday I'll sort of take a different track. But the predictions or the calculations for inflation and fluctuations were done back in 1982. That was 20 years almost before the COBE data. The calculations showed the detailed angular power spectrum of microwave anisotropies. So if you don't call that a prediction.
So that was powerful, yeah. So I don't want to understand.
I mean, the problem is that it's not a unique prediction of inflation.
Yeah, you could have done the same calculation based on another mechanism.
Yeah. That's right. In fact, there's a 1970 paper by Kunyayev and Zavrovich, which has essentially the same.
Yeah.
But that was just sort of an assumption of scalar theory.
That's clearly right.
That is really complicated.
Okay.
Then last week a talk where Paul Steinhardt tried to convince us that the bouncing universe is better. Can you can you somehow say where inflation might be?
But that would be a very interesting talk, but it's not what I'm going to discuss today. So I don't think I will have anything to say about that. I think it's a very interesting issue that we can defer to offline discussion. Otherwise, I won't get to the point.
Is there going to be a panel fight later in the week?
What was it? I missed the question.
Well, she's asking whether bouncing universes are better than inflation.
When is that? Wednesday. What time is it now? Fixed now?
Probably the same time as yours.
Okay, so keep your question for when. Okay.
I'm not the boring Leonardo who had a debate with himself on this, or he's in case of that.
Who will defend the bouncing?
You will, you have the working model.
You have the working model.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so I just wanted to mention a few things. On the list of precision measurement, what could we discover and what would be exciting? And I will just mention a couple of things. So one thing that would be exciting would be to see tensor modes in the CMB. So far there is a bound on the tensor to scalar ratio, which should be smaller than 0.2 from WMAP 7-year data and supernova. And so the interesting thing is that interpreted within the inflationary mechanism, this would measure the energy. If you want this parameter, which was undetermined by 10 order of magnitude, would be measured. If we detect tensor modes and interpret them within the inflationary paradigm. Another set of interesting observables that I would like to mention, because they will be relevant in the model that I'm going to present, and Rafael will say much more about it, are non-Gaussianity that you might detect in the three-point function of cosmological perturbations. So far there are bounds which are of order 1%, but remember that the bounds are really shape dependent, so we have not tested all possible non-Gaussian shapes against the data. And this is exciting because the simplest, what I call the simplest model of inflation, would be ruled out by this measurement. So you would have to go to a less simple, in a certain sense, a less naive model of inflation. So this is why it would be exciting, also for people working in the field. And of course, there are many other things, such as isocurvature, curvature, or features in the spectrum, and all these are really interesting things. And I think the model I'm going to describe has something to say about it. But for the purpose of this talk, I will really concentrate just on the theoretical soundness and the relation with the tensor modes.
Yes. So, which models from string theory would survive non-Gaussianities?
In general, I would say that first, it depends which kind of non-Gaussianity you detect. So I guess it.
The best one? I think he's just going to present.
But there are many models that can produce non-Gaussianities, and they have different shapes. So I don't know. I mean, if you get something which has a large equilateral non-Gaussianity, then DBI would be a good candidate, even though there is not really a clear way to embed that in string theory. So I mean, I would phrase the question: which effective model would be compatible with non-Gaussianities, and then how do we embed this effective model in string theory? So I think it's easier for interpreting data to have these two steps.
A lot of the two-field models embedding in string theory probably wouldn't teach you anything. I mean, it's some relatively tame ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And the question's being deferred not because it's not a key question, but just because Raphael's giving a whole talk on it.
For example, I mean, as I said before, thinking about soundness and about some theoretical issues, you might come up with some non-trivial connection between observables, for example, between tensor modes and non-Gaussianities, and this is what happens in this class of models, and that will be the subject of the talk. I will mention during the talk how this arises and in which sense. This is kind of the idea that even in this class of models that you have some non-trivial interplay between observation and theory, for example, via the life bound, observation of tensor modes tells you something about the range of variation of the inflaton, and therefore which kind of theoretical robustness do you need to require to your theory in order to describe that. And And as a feedback, theory gives you some non-trivial interplay, for example, between tensor modes and resonant non-Gaussianity, which is, or features in the potential, which is something that takes place in this model. So this is what Rafael will discuss tomorrow, and then I'm trying more to concentrate on the relationship between tensor modes, large field models of inflation in a fundamental, in a UV finite theory. So this is kind of the life bound, which is the first step. So as we said, I mean, detecting tensor mode interpreted within inflation would tell us that the scale at which inflation took place was very close to the gut scale, and life found another consequences of this fact, which is that the variation of the inflaton during inflation, so the length of the inflationary trajectory measured in Planck unit, has to be bigger than this quantity, where R is the tensor to scalar ratio. So if we detect something, it means that this quantity is bigger than one. So this is of course within the single field models. So the idea is that we would have to come up with a description of a theory in which we are varying the sum of the fields of the theory by a distance which is typically bigger than the cutoff. So let's say that we use an effective field theory to describe this. Then the highest up that we can push the cutoff is Planck scale if you use an effective field theory. And so we would be sure that we would be working in effective field theory where the VEV of the fields that we are using take values which are bigger than the cutoff of the theory. And then, I mean, there are several, if you want, general arguments why you should be worried about it, and there are some more specific arguments that you can find out in discussing some specific model, which is what I will do today. That when this happens, you should be worried whether you can use or not your effective field theories. And maybe it's a good idea to try to embed a model in which there is a super cutoff variation of the field within a fundamental theory, which you can ask whether there are further correction arising. And I will.
It's four-dimensional.
So this is 10 to the 18 GeV. Sorry, yes, GeV. So it's reduced in Planck. And so this will be the main motivation. So the punchline is that this is kind of the interplay between observation and theory, that if we detect tensor modes within inflation, this would mean high-scale inflation, which means large field, which means that there is more UV sensitive. So let me elaborate on what do I mean with UV sensitive, and in which sense I'm kind of advocating that this kind of model, we could learn something embedding this kind of model in a UV finite theory of gravity. So the effective field theory approach, which is what I contrast to the fundamental theory approach, is based on the idea of writing down all operators compatible with the symmetries with order one coefficient, and the dimension is just fixed by powers of the cutoff. And it has been a very powerful tool in analyzing particle physics. For example, even if you're doing experiments up to a GeV or 100 GeV, you can still put bounds using effective field theory ideas on the physics that takes place at much higher scale. For example, if you just measure the lifetime of the proton, then you can put very strong bounds on flavor violating operators, which are, you can say that they cannot come up to energies which are of order GATT, for example, even if you're not directly investigating GATT. And in a similar way, inflation is a mechanism which is UV sensitive in an even stronger way, in a certain sense. What I mean is that if you start with the naive model, the one that you can solve on with a back of the envelope calculation, and allow yourself to do what effective field theory approach tells you, which means write down all the operators compatible with the symmetry of the problem, you find that any one of them would basically spoil the dynamics that you had before.
Unless you have a shift symmetry.
Exactly, yes. So I'm coming to the point. I totally agree. So of course, I just wanted to say that before you start arguing, thinking about the presence of a symmetry or not, I mean, this might be just a generic concern, you might just forbid them, but okay, let me say that. So from the effective field theory point of view, the way you would go about would be, okay, I mean, there is just a symmetry forbidding them, and so I don't have to write them down to begin with, because I'm writing down only those compatible with the symmetries of the problem. What I want to advocate here is that in effective field theory, when you are assuming that there is a symmetry, you can either assume that that symmetry is just a fundamental symmetry of nature, which is valid to infinite energies, or but then you have to really assume something about the energies above the cutoff, which is a bit in contrast to the approach that you have once you're doing effective field theory.
You don't really need energies, you need field strength. These are two different things.
They are two different things, I agree, but if you assume that there are general coupling between this field and other fields, you, what you would expect is that the masses of these other fields would change by as much as the cutoff of the theory when you change the dive of the field by more than the cutoff. So I would say that there is a way in which you convert dives in energy. And I mean,
but if the field is changed by Planck, the mass will change by Planck, so it's still at the cutoff
of the second field. Yeah, I mean, like, let's say that we want to do chaotic inflation, it changes by 10, 15 and Planck.
From Planck to 10 Planck. I mean,
so all fields that are above the cutoff of your effective field theory can potentially come down, and you just have to assume that they were not there. So I'm saying it requires assuming something about the theory that, I mean, it's really the effective field theory idea.
Much, right? I don't think that it's very much, right? The discussion is not much more than this. And they cut off in the sense of the
gravity
field. So,
yes. You mean orders of magnitude? I consider enough.
There's not many orders of magnitude.
One is already enough. I mean, it's just you cannot integrate them out. And I mean, this is when you push the cutoff to Planck.
If the field is a Planck,
yes.
Then it becomes.
It becomes zero, let's say.
Well,
if you vary the mass.
Over the one. I mean, then you have tuning to
the light. I'm saying.
If the, zero, the mass, no?
I think if you have something, some other field chi squared plus phi squared plus m squared, I'm saying that if you change this one by something which is of order the cutoff, even if the mass of the field chi was of order the cutoff, it can come below it.
Still of order the cutoff unless you have something.
I mean, of course you are changing phi, delta phi is much bigger than the cutoff, right? So this is delta phi is much bigger than Planck, which is bigger than the cutoff, technically. So I mean, you're changing this one by much more than the cutoff. So yeah, I mean, I can give you, if you want, these are generic arguments, so that they seem a bit empty. But in concrete realizations of this, so you can really touch it with your hand. This is what is happening. So maybe I can we can argue in an explicit realization on construction of these ideas. What do I mean with this worry? But I mean. Okay.
This is a question for you and or Eva. Since these are global symmetries, how do you think of them as being protected in a theory with gravity?
Yeah, exactly. You would expect in general that they might be broken, and you would like not to assume that they are not broken or not to assume that they are broken at a certain, but to have a way to investigating when they are broken, at which scale, and how, and by how much. So you would expect that in a theory with gravity there shouldn't be global symmetries, for example. And then you might ask, yeah, so what about the protection of these operators?
Well, I think it's helpful to consider the specific case that he's getting to, which is axions. So roughly half the fields are angular fields, like axions. Mm-hmm. The shift symmetries are broken into discrete subgroups by things like Hinzenberg, but those instances can be naturally exponentially small. So I don't mean to.
No, exactly. Yeah, this is what you would discover because you do a realization of the model. Then you
even
can.
Even the discrete symmetries in the end, they're often broken as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the point.
That's the guy.
But then they're no longer symmetric. So, yeah.
Well,
what protects them?
This is a small breaking parameter.
Yeah.
What's then the small parameter?
Is the physics that it breaks it that it explains at a certain energy, which is much bigger than the energy at which you do inflation. So that the small parameter would be h over the energy at which the symmetries are broken.
Okay, so in the original Lemsford Weisberg model, smallness to match the Kobe normalization of the power spectrum, which conveniently in that model or in any version of the equation is small enough that it's the whole thing is radically stable. So that thing which breaks the shift symmetry doesn't generate higher production.
Exactly. So yeah, in particular, if you start with this one, it's just a free theory, and then you have gravity, but gravity generates a small loop. So yes, it's radiatively stable.
So you're using the fact that this field, is associated with physics at a lower energy as well? Or?
Yes. I'm saying that there is an approximate symmetry at low energies, and the thing that breaks this symmetry are surprised by the energy at which this symmetry is no more a good symmetry. I mean, that is coming down, and above you have the energy at which you're doing the physics here, which is Hubble scale during inflation. So this is the suppression parameter. What I'm saying is that if you want to ask what is the scale at which this symmetry is broken, and is this infinity or is it finite and how much it is, then you cannot do effective. You cannot just say, well, assume that there is a symmetry. So in trying to embed this one in a theory, you can ask when is the symmetry broken, at which scale, and if it is broken, no perturbative.
Yeah, the scale at which it's broken, because it's a dimensionful. So phi itself, so the log, is, you're not going to tell me that the lambdas are going to be suppressed.
The log?
The lambda n. Lambda n would be of order 1.
I'm going to estimate this one. I mean, in the sense, I'm going to do a particular construction in which there is a shift symmetry, and I will tell you how big this is.
Then the question is, you're going to tell me what the mechanism, so it's not going to be the M Planck that's sitting there, it's going to be the
something else, yes. This is just a naive effective field theory approach, what you would expect, but then you can actually do it and have precise answer to precise questions. At this level, you just don't know really about it.
Roughly, it would be powers of little m over m Planck. And this is a strange example because it's free. But roughly, the small parameter would be little m over m Planck. And that would appear with extra powers. So that's what I'm arguing.
And the thing that's preventing little m from being as large as m Planck is...
It's the first effect that breaks the symmetry by tough naturalness. It could be arbitrarily small.
And there are examples you might talk about. It's more of that or something.
But I think that when I present the explicit model, then I think all this, I mean, most of these questions will have a clear answer in that model, within that model.
I mean, I think there's an analogy here to supersymmetric model thing, where if you choose supersymmetry, then you get various protections, but in making that choice, you have definitely made a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yes. No, I agree.
It should be familiar in your
logic. Okay, so then I'm asking, to ask all these questions, and then we try to construct an explicit model in which at least we can compute when the symmetry is broken, whether it's broken, and by how much. So this is what I'm really going to ask exactly the same questions, but trying to do it where they can have a definite answer and not just an argument as an answer. So what are the difficulties that we have in trying to implement models of large field inflation, especially in fundamental theory? So from now on, I will focus on string theory. Well, there are two kinds of issues. What I mentioned before was just the issue of flatness, that you want the potential to be flat over a range which is much bigger than the cutoff. But there is actually also another kind of issue, which is you want to have at least a field range which is large enough. I mean, if you want a variation delta phi bigger than Planck, then you need a field range which is bigger. And that's also an issue which wasn't... which is not very easily solved in certain models. For example, in brain inflation, is just no matter how you scale the parameters, the field space is just not large enough. And the same is kind of the issue of embedding natural inflation in string theory, the fact that typically axiom decay constants are sub-Planckian. So the size of the field space is not large enough. So what I'm reviewing here is the idea proposed by Eva, Alexander Westphal, and a follow-up paper also by Liam, by the three of them, and is that the axiom monodromy can kind of address these two issues. And this is what is the idea. It is that we start with a field which has a compact field space, and let's say that this compact field space is some kind of angular variable. So this compact field space, it's something like the length of this is 2 pi times the axiom decay constant, something which is smaller than Planck, so in principle there is not enough space. And what I'm saying is that introducing a monodromy would change this compact space into some space which is non-compact. So you would have enough space. And the interesting thing is that with the same mechanism, you would also have a potential whose flatness is protected by a symmetry. So I will write down that in a more specific way in a toy model. But before I do that, let me say just a few words about axioms, and then I will write down the potential. So the idea of axiom is an old idea. It was proposed already. Well, I mean, you can have axioms in field theory from, for example, the Goldstone boson of some global symmetry, for example, U1 symmetry, as it was invoked for the Strong-CP problem. I mean, when I'm saying axiom, what I mean is that the field which has only derivative couplings in the Lagrangian, and therefore the Lagrangian is invariant under a constant shift. And I mean, typically this is an important point. If you start with a Lagrangian which has this property is valid to all order in perturbation theory. It's not valid anymore non-perturbatively, so we typically expect non-perturbative breaking of the shift symmetry that we are assuming here. And this will be very, very relevant for the phenomenology of the model, for example. And yeah, just one important parameter here is the axion decay constant. In particle physics, you think of it as the strength of the interaction of the axion. Maybe in cosmology, it's kind of more useful to think of it as the periodicity of the leading non-perturbative effect. So this is some non-perturbative effect, which is periodic in the field, and the period is the axion decay constant. So this lambda would be exponentially suppressed in 1 over some cutoff. Okay, so this is the kind of the simple example. You start with something which has a shift symmetry. So the potential is just constant in that field. It can depend on the other constants. And then, as we said, you might have exponentially suppressed non-perturbative effects that still you should take into account, because they might be exponentially suppressed at an energy which is GATT, but they're still important for your physics. And we will see that this puts some non-trivial constraints, but this also gives some kind of interesting phenomenological consequence, which Rafael will talk about. Yes.
Example of Olinto and company.
Yes, exactly.
But the point is, if you want to map it onto typical string theory parameters, it doesn't work.
Yeah, the reason it doesn't work is what I was trying to say here. So their idea was to start with a potential which is lambda to the 4, 1 minus cosine of phi over f for a canonically normalized phi. And if you plot that potential, it's like this. And this is 2 pi f. And this model can fit the WMAP data only if f is bigger than 3.5 M Planck. Otherwise, it doesn't. The intuition is that when f is so large, well, this part of the potential is almost indistinguishable from chaotic inflation. So this is kind of the main issue. If you want, you can interpret this fact meaning that you want enough space. If you don't have enough space, this thing is too steep because it's going from here to here in a little space. So, and the problem is that in string theory, you have generic arguments that I will review, while these things is very hard to achieve, because typically the axion decay constant scales as, let's say, f squared scales as g string over some volume times m Planck squared. So in control situation in which g string is small and the volumes are large, such that your supergravity description is valid, this thing is much smaller than in Planck, and that's why it's hard to embed it.
Open the possibility
that
in the generic middle of moduli space, where it's hard to compute, but which might be more generic.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Well,
yeah. This is a statement. In controlled situations, it's hard to have it. But if you are able to compute, also when it is strong coupling and non-supergravity, because you have some other arguments, I think it would be very exciting. It would be a more stringy way of implementing these ideas.
Let me ask another general question.
Yes.
If you really want large field inflation, your lambda here, which we think of as being exponentially small, is still going to be 10 to the 16 GeV or higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the space you have between the effective theory, which you wrote down with one field, and the real theory that has an infinite tower of KK modes and all this other junk, is very small. I mean, this theory has to be valid at 10 to the 16 GeV, mm-hmm. The string scale is 10 to the 17 GeV. How do you think of really getting space to justify the truncation to a single field?
I think it's you can compute corrections. I would say that's the best way. If you think that those corrections are large enough that they spoil your inflation, because it's not that anything we cannot compute will spoil inflation, right? It needs to depend on the inflaton. It needs either to give large perturbation or to change the background. So, I mean, if you think that there is a particular KK mode that would change your physics, you compute corrections, and if they're large, the model is out. So I agree that there is a tension. Of course, we want to inflate this energy, and here is Planck, and here is string scale, it is called is Kaluza-Klein scale, etc. But, I mean, in principle, there is a construction. You compute the correction.
Yeah, this is also true of any kind of attempt to do gut scale model building within a string theory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Possible threshold effects.
And this is what makes it interesting in a certain sense.
One can also try, as will occur in the case that he'll describe, to arrange that the moduli barrier that comes from the leading non-perturbative effect is of the order that you described, but the leading thing giving a contribution to the potential there arises at a two-instanton level. So then there's a substantial splitting between the size of the moduli barriers, which have to be that scale, and the size of the modulations for the potential.
Oh, okay, yeah. If you don't have driving inflation, but just be modulation, right. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which would be the case in what he's going to describe.
Yeah, this
is for natural inflation, as you said.
Yeah, this would be the case. Maybe I should have come to that earlier. So I'm saying that these are corrections, and what I want to get the 60 folding from will be an explicit breaking of the shift symmetry. So this was the idea that we had before. This is explicit, it breaks the shift symmetry, and the main point is that it does it in a controlled way, in the sense that all the breaking of shift symmetry is proportional to m. So even after you have broken, you get further correction radiatively generated by this term. They should contains powers of m divided by some cutoff, because when m goes to 0, this correction has to go to 0. So the idea is that even if you break it, the amount of control that you maintain is the fact that everything should be organized in an expansion of the parameter, the leading parameter that breaks the symmetry, which is the basic idea of having broken symmetries. So, I mean, the question is, this is the effective field theory idea, and it's a nice idea, but there are many questions that are not easy to address, like what is this physics, at which scale is generated, is it large, all this set of questions that they can be asked if we try to embed this kind of effective field theory idea into an explicit model in string theory, which is what I'm going to do now.
Well, it's embedded if it's instant ungenerated, if it's not perturbed superpotential, you have it m-string into the minus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I will argue that in the case that we are interested in that effect, it is small, so it doesn't change the amount of e-folding. There is a regime in which it is, because it's exponentially suppressed.
I'm probably being a little slow, but what prevents a term that goes like the cutoff squared times phi squared, the usual quadratic divergences with scalar potentials?
The fact that when m goes to 0, that there is a shift symmetry to lower order perturbation theory. So when m is 0, you cannot generate that perturbatively with any graph.
Yeah, but you might think non-perturbatively, or when you include gravitational effects, you
would. It's like the pion, right? I mean, you can say what prevents the pion mass from being raised, and, well, it's protected by symmetry, and the QCD scale gives it a mass, but until QCD breaks the symmetry, it can't get a mass.
I mean, there is, as you're worried about, a mass term coming at the non-perturbative level from expanding the cosine, but he's going to compute, as Miriam was suggesting, what lambda is in a string dimensification, and then effectively control that issue by making that small.
And all that can possibly do is modulate the potential on a very short.
And is
this
just
that
mass, or how
should
I think about that?
It's not really
going to
be
m squared
phi.
No, exactly. This is just for the discussion. I had discussion in which I was writing here m cubed phi, but then there were even more discussions, so I decided to write down m squared phi squared. But this is just the effective field theory idea. We are trying to embed this idea in a construction and then ask the question. Okay, so just in a second, the last slide about really phenomenology. So if we were able to embed this model in string theory, what would we get? The main point that we started all the discussion from is that we would get tensor mode. So that's the main motivation. In terms of really what like NS, the spectral tilt, etc., that depends on the detail of this term that breaks the shift symmetry, that I'm calling monodromy term there. So that depends on that term, on the details of that. So this kind, if you want, the model would lie somewhere here in the bulk of the WMF 5-year data, because it would have some non-trivial some potentially detectable tensor modes. And I mean, there are some other, there is a lot of interesting phenomenology coming from this non-perturbative effect, but that will be the subject of tomorrow's discussion. So can we implement this in string theory? So what about, the first thing is that we need to have the field, right? So the axiom field, and that's not a problem in string theory. There are actually even too many of them. So there are model independent axioms, such that those that you obtain in the four-dimensional low energy effective action from dualizing two forms, polarized in the space-time directions. And there are also model dependent axioms that come from integrating p forms over p cycle of the compact manifold. So I mean, the field is definitely there. And what we said before is still true, that the shift symmetry of this one, there are arguments that is valid to all order in perturbation theory, but is broken non-perturbatively. Where non-perturbative here means the presence of brain, typically. Either Worksheet instantons or brain instantons, all those things would break the shift symmetry. And also the axiom decay constant, which is the main parameter appearing here, will be determined by geometrical data of the compactification. So you can compute it and say which value do you get. And as I was mentioning before, in controlled setups, this is sub-Planckian. Then you can hope that there are some other ways to control it also when it is not weakly coupled or not supergravity. The description. Okay, so. This is an old argument due to Van, Witten, Dine, and Zeiberg about the shift symmetry that the four-dimensional axion has. And I mean, the simplest way to show it is that doing bosonic closed string theory, and you want to ask what is the potential for an axion coming from the integral of the two-form B. So I'm expanding into some some two forms of the compact space, and then you can just compute this one. And I mean, we want to focus at the zero momentum coupling, so the non-derivative coupling. And then if you compute this one, the integral over the worksheet is nothing but the integral over the target space embedding of the worksheet. And then at all ordering perturbation theory, the target space is a shrinkable Riemann manifold, and therefore this integral is zero. This integral would not be zero if you were to wrap some non-trivial cycle, so at non-perturbative or at non-perturbative expansion of string theory. So this is the argument that it is still true in string theory that at perturbative level there is a shift symmetry, but of course there are two important exceptions, which are either non-perturbative effects such as brains or worksheet instantons, or when this worksheet has boundaries, then again the argument fails. So you have to ask about those. Okay, so let me start introducing the ingredients for constructing this kind of modeling string theory. So I will follow the proposal by Liam, Eva, and Alexander of a couple of years ago. So we start just considering type 2B orientifolds, and then in the n equal 1 four-dimensional effective action, our candidate axiom will be the integral of a Ramon-Ramon 2 form over a 2 cycle that we argued as a shift symmetry at all order in perturbation theory. And then the idea is that we need to introduce a monodromy that is possibly controlled. So the way a proposal to introduce this monodromy is to wrap a 5-brain over these 2 cycles, a space-time filling 5-brain over these 2 cycles. And of course the action of the brain, I mean, as we said, is a non-perturbative effect, so that would break the shift symmetry. And the way to do it that in a controlled way, so if we're not able to kind of make this effect small or large, then you wouldn't have control on the breaking of this shift symmetry. So that's why you can try to embed that one in a warped region, such that the leading term that breaks the shift symmetry is the tension of the brain, but it's the word red-shifted tension. So you can try to change the word factor there to make this effect controllably small. That's the idea. Yes.
Do you have a picture where you could illustrate this monodromy? Like in the initial model where there were 2 brains moving relative to each other, and I could visualize the string as giving rise to the monodromy.
Mm-hmm.
So I was basically wondering if you have an intuitive picture.
I mean, I can use the picture that you had on your paper about it's a T-dual picture. I think the T-dual picture is more intuitive than just saying that there is some flux on a 2 cycle of a 5 brain. I think that the T-dual picture you can see is really the staircase appearing, so I don't know if that's more intuitive. In a sense, the idea is that...
Could you maybe use white chalk?
So the idea is that you start in a configuration in which when you change the value of this field by 2 pi times f at some period, it's just the configuration is undistinguishable from the point that you started from. It's just you come back to the same point. Once you add the brain, every time you go around it once, then the configuration is distinguishable because you have loaded one unit of flux in that direction. So if you want to interpret in a T-dual picture, it's like if there were some 4 brains stretching between 2 5 brains, if I remember correctly. Maybe you should correct me. And then. And then the idea is that if you do n times, then there is some extra amount of charge that is recording the fact that you went n times around it. So they know that you have to go n times back in order to get this configuration that you started from. So I don't know if that's intuitive.
Maybe you want to say more about it, but since you just mentioned the fact that you want to bring a more convenient, are there examples where one explicitly knows what sets the scale of the warp factor? Fluxes are used to set the scale of the warp factor.
We in particular, which are like three-form fluxes in type 2B, so you want something more specific, I guess?
No, I want to know if it's actually the flux that you're charging by doing this binding or not, whether that's important.
No. I would say the flux is coming from three-form flux, like H3 and F3 flux. as in hierarchies from.
But that, those fluxes remain fixed during your monotony.
Exactly. The idea is that those are stabilized at a scale which is higher than the scale at which inflation takes place, so they do not change by a large amount.
You have to make sure that this whole wind-up toy doesn't back react strongly.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
The charges that are being built up in your wind-up toy are affecting your stabilization.
Yes, yes. Now, one has to estimate that. Yes. No, no, definitely.
In particular, you don't want a lot of warping because you want, again, you want to inflate 10 to the 16 GeV.
Yes.
So yeah. The warping is a factor of 10. And so the amount of background flux that you have is not that large. And if you wind it up very much,
You change it by one, right. It would already be.
The warp factor has got to be 10 here, right?
I'm not sure if it is really 10. I mean, if you want, in the implementation that we will do, well, it is next slide, but I will start from an action. Well, let me go to next slide and then I will. I'm saying that if this is kind of the potential that we will end up, this one can be 10 to the minus 4 and plus. So it doesn't have to be.
That's the magic.
Yes, exactly. So that's what COBE does, actually. Yeah.
So the energy scale of the tip will be 10 to the 16 GeV after you include the 5 dev, but the mu parameter can be smaller. Than
mm-hmm. Yeah.
One question is, what about temporal cancellation? So
yes, precisely. We should cancel that ball, and in fact,
Does this mean that the overall charge on the cycle is vanishing?
Exactly. So in fact, the idea is that to implement this one, we cannot add just one D5 brain, we have to add two D5 brains. But of course, to make the system metastable, to make the system metastable, that we are assuming that there is a family of two cycles. Let's say this is a family of two cycles, sigma 2, that depends, they're all homologous, so you can just go from one to the other continuously, they depend on some parameter, gamma. And then this is where the NS5 brain sits, the NS5 brains inside a warped throat. And then there is another NS5 brain, NS5 bar brains, which has exactly the opposite charge and is wrapping the same cycle, well, with opposite orientation, such that it cancels the total charge. And of course, the system is metastable, but the metastability is determined by the action of the instanton that goes all the way into the bulk and then annihilates with this one if you want, and so it can be made long-lived. So if you want, yeah, there is just a tunneling. I mean, it's classically stable, but quantum.
It's an
NS5 brain. So at the level that I want to generate a monodomy for C2 is going to be an NS5. If I want to generate a monodomy for B2 is a D5. But I will argue that exactly the non-trivial constraints that you mentioned before about non-perturbative effect makes B2 not a suitable candidate for inflation.
And that's, it may not have been clear why it was C2, but it's because he's going to get the monodomy from the DBI or S2L DBI, actually not from the Schrodinger sinus coupling.
Yeah, that was coming in the next slide. Yeah, sorry. Maybe I'm too slow. I should have jumped. So, and then I will check that the moduli stabilization is consistent with what you're saying. That is very important because the moduli stabilization, for example, at KKLT, includes some non-perturbative effect after all. So it's not obvious that they should be small.
I mean, it might be worth mentioning the flux of the generic thing is also.
Yes. Okay, so.
But I mean, that was somehow Herman's question whether that was dominant. And I think the claim is that here he's going to be considering a case where although they may well induce such monotomies, he's picking a regime where they're suppressed.
Okay, this is just one possibility to introduce a monotomy. Yeah? So this is how we kind of try to estimate what the potential is. So consider a 5 brain, the DBI action looks something like this. And this is where the B appears. So if you're assuming that this 5 brain is space-time filling, but is wrapping a 2 cycle, and then you expand this one around that 2 cycle, and you look at the 4-dimensional field. That's an axiom for the arguments that we gave before. The shift symmetry of this axiom is broken by the presence of the brain, and is broken as much as basically what the DBI action tells you, which is the tension of the brain times the square root. This is the volume of the 2 cycle wrapped by the brain, and this is where B appears. So if you want, I mean, this potential is going to be some kind of wedge. And then, I mean, I could have written the square root all over my slides. So just for simplicity, I will write the linear potential, which is the expansion of the square root when b is large enough, that if you introduce the right factors, it is the case. But if you want, I mean, don't think it is unbounded from below. There is a minimum which is here. It just when I'm doing it for phenomenological purposes here, you can think of it as being linear. So it doesn't differ so much from linear, but this is the shape you get. And then the idea is that, I mean, the main point was that this thing should be controllably small. And the parameter that controls it is basically the tension. And if the tension is warped, then this parameter can be made small, such that higher correction, they come with higher powers of this, as was the main idea in the effective field theory approach. And I mean, this calculation is for D5 brain. So by S-duality, you expect that an NS5 brain would generate a monodromy for the field C.
Make a connection with supersymmetry predicate. Is this the same kind of argument by which you hope to stabilize a low supersymmetry breaking scale in such a...
For a D3 bar, for example, the fact that supersymmetry breaking is small is because it is warped down. So in that sense...
Can I ask a question about this? I asked me, but I couldn't understand offline. So T5 is going to be small because of warping. Then you'll have a huge B there that gives you a large energy. As a result, actually the energy at the end of your throat is not going to be the warp scale. It's going to be parametrically higher. Your warp scale is a small parameter T5, which is your mu, mm-hmm. and the energy actually there is much higher. So you have a warped throat where the scale at the end of the throat is much smaller than the energy density you put there. Why doesn't that back react and make the throat shorter? I mean, introduce an ADS black hole or something.
So the way we try to estimate how shorter the throat becomes, was in estimating the amount. When you put flux on the 5 brain, you effectively introduce some amount of D3 charge. That's from the Chern-Simon term, because it couples to C4 once you have a VEV for B. And we have estimated that one. We have calculated when that one is smaller than the background D3 charge. So that's a way to estimate when...
At the level of energetics, it's still confusing, though, because it would be like in Randall syndrome, having energy much larger than a TDP or localized at the infrared brain. You'd think it would do something to...
Well, I mean, Hubble is way smaller than a
block. But maybe that's the point. Hubble is comparable at the end of the throat. But not Viva Hubble.
I mean, his right answer was just that the throat that would be produced by these three brains, effectively, is way smaller than the proper size of the throat of
the block. Oh, and that energy is just the three brain action.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
And also the KK scale of the throat is, although this is slightly delicate to ensure we did.
Yeah, I wouldn't mention that.
The KK scale of the throat, even the bottom part, is above Hubble.
This kind of question does point to the fact that you can't just easily get to internal inflation
in this arbitrary part. Yeah, the VEV of the field, yes.
So it's only the V squared part that's turning on the fraction, V zero, there's no energy.
Well, I mean, B0, there is this one, sorry.
There's that one. Anyway. How big is that one?
So
that's not the size of Hubble? That's the size, no.
That's small compared to Hubble.
That could be zero for all we care. But
how do you make it zero?
No, I mean, it depends if you started from... You mean if you started from ADS and you get the total zero cosmological constant? No, you're talking about the localization of energy.
So you basically assume that your things are canceled out in such a way that...
You have to dial the tension such that 2 times T5 square root all the fourth evaluated at the VEV of L at the end of the day exactly solves the vacuum energy in a modulus stabilized vacuum for some, let's say, ADS4 K by T0.
I mean, the cosmological constant, yeah, is just still too fixed to zero. So
your Suzy Brain scale will be huge.
Yeah.
How big is B dot over B?
B dot?
B dot over, once it starts to roll, how
big is B dot? B dot is almost constant, so it's like in slow roll inflation.
But slow roll depends on the scale of your potential.
So phi dot, I don't know, do you remember it by heart? It's like 1 over phi squared.
So epsilon is 1 over phi squared, so...
I think it's something like, it's 1 over phi squared? No, Hubble over phi squared, I think.
Well, 2 epsilon is 1 over phi squared in functionality.
If I put h here, this is square root of 2 epsilon times h over phi. So this is h over phi squared. Or you don't?
I can normalize phi as it fits the scale of that.
So you want to know this one? I mean, in Planck unit, is it 10 to the minus 7 or so? Well, I mean,
I know that if the axiom k constant had been of order in Planck, and generically what happens is that phi dot over phi becomes smaller than Hubble scale by some slow roll parameter. But if the scale of your potential and the scale of your decay constant are all roughly the same size, then phi dot over phi becomes something like a slow roll parameter times that scale. And so there's an issue as to whether or not that, where that is compared to your cutoff and H.
I mean, maybe you're talking about the kind of the oscillations of the background at which frequency sets in. I'm not sure why phi dot over phi. What does this phi mean? Where does this come from?
Well, if you're doing effective field theory in a time-dependent background, one of the assertions you make is that the time dependence, capturing the time dependence of the solutions to the effective field theory, are capturing the time dependence of the full theory. That only works in the adiabatic approximations.
Yes, I would have estimated kind of this.
So one of the scales you need to worry about is phi dot over phi. How that compares to the whatever your cutoff was.
So I mean, when you say phi dot over phi, you mean the typical frequency?
Just you've got some motion, so just speed out once you do.
Okay, but that is like in slow roll. I mean, that's very small if it is like in slow roll. So if you don't have these oscillations, which here I'm not really advocating, I'm just talking about the smooth part of the potential that is exactly as in slow roll inflation.
Your question would have to apply to m squared phi squared also. Does it?
Well, it might, because the thing is, for slow roll, it depends on the kind of slow roll. That's why it depends on the decay constant. So if it's slow roll where you've got a energy scale, say V in your potential, but a decay constant F, which is bigger than like the Planck scale or something, then this is always smaller than the Hubble scale. But if the slow roll, if all the scales in your scalar sector, like the decay constant and the potential, are the same size, then this is smaller than that, but not necessarily smaller.
Okay, so.
Well, so you're worried about non-adiabaticity in what is it that you think of creating. So here there's a specific microscopic where it's true that if you took the spell to be small, as your brains keep coming closer to each other, you can produce complex strings actually in this model. But it depends on the microscopics.
Well, there's two issues. One of them is the Shell mixed list, so that's if you've got lots of energy and you're compared to, say, a string scale in a scorp throat, then having energy in itself isn't a problem because the cosmological constant, you know, you can't get energy out of it. But once you start to move in that potential, the question is the energy releasing big compared to, you know, are you throat producing?
But that's why trying to platform the omega dot over omega squared. So then what we did is estimate for all the fields that we could find, I mean, all the fields we could think about, that possibly have large omega dot over omega squared, yeah, whether it's small or large compared to one. And in a special case in the model Raphael we'll talk about tomorrow, that is larger than one, and modes do get produced, and that gives interesting signatures, you might say, and non-destructive ones. But in the model we're talking about today, which is smooth, then there are no signatures.
But there's a separate issue independent of particle direction. Just is the classical equations, the solution to the classical equations in the effective theory tracking the field theory. And that typically works in effective field theory in the adiabatic approximation only.
Well, if you say it's non-adiabatic, then what you're saying is that you have some kind of production of an excited state. So what distinction are you making between?
I don't know if those are necessarily the same thing, because you're saying that if I have something which is moving non-adiabatically, I have to be part of the fission particle from something.
Well, that's what non-adiabatic means, right? You're exciting an excited state, so I'm asking what state it is.
Can I just ask you to separate? So the potential, let's say, there's some background part, let's say, this cube phi, and some non-perturbative correlations. So of which one? About if you're, I mean, worried about this, you're just worried that in slow roll studies that it is non-adiabatic, that slow roll dynamics is non-adiabatic, or you're worried about this oscillating term?
I was more hoping you could just tell me the scale. So
can you do that restricting to just the mu phi? Can we have a discussion about an effective theory which is just kinetic term 1/2 d phi squared and potential mu phi?
Yeah.
In that model, how do you ask the question in that model?
So in that case, what are the scales in that model? So you've got an m for the
just
the
mu and the phi.
And what's the
mu is 1/2 d phi squared. Yeah.
The only thing it doesn't do there.
For phi, it's canonically normalized already, and so there's just one mass parameter mu which is small, and then he wrote that.
And mu is
well, f is gone now. I mean, if we can ask the question of the effective theory, where there isn't even an F anymore, just normalize the thing.
If you just care about this, Kobe imposes mu 6 10 to the minus 4 and Planck, and then this is where you get your CMB 60 foldings to the n is about 10 and Planck.
So you couple the gravities, you would have to be worrying about something to do with that. But that's the only interaction.
but then the variation, it is slow, but the background changes slowly. I mean, it is slow wrong. Well, slow is draw slow with respect to Hubble, okay. H tau.
Yeah, but Hubble's not necessarily the only non-geodetic scale in the problem, right? That's more or less not what I mean.
And if we don't include this one, it is kind of, there is only Hubble. If we don't include the number two radial effect, then you're saying, when I include them, what happens? This is your worry.
But to rephrase that in Eva's question, I mean, you're saying we should be thinking about other sectors, right? And evaluating the non-geodeticity parameter on some other sector, whether a Planckian mass is, or a sector related to the stabilization, or some other thing. The confusing thing is, when if the question is asked only about field 5, then it seems clear that everything is slowly there. So which field, you want to consider some other sector from the string identification, or?
Well, take the guys in the tip of the throat that are the lightest guys in the
throat. Yeah, okay, the tip of the climax. Right, so that, there we evaluated omega dot over omega squared for those, okay. To check that they're small. It was important to check. Maybe the claim is that all those, that's why you wrote that there. You evaluated all those.
So what you checked was omega dot over omega squared was smaller than
one.
And then these guys, the masses of the guys that tip that throat.
No, omega dot over omega squared for omega corresponding to the frequency of the physical modes, like including finite excitations, is a small compared to unity, so they don't get populated.
So, by the way, if they do get populated, then that drains energy from the implanton and helps it to roll more slowly, so that's another scenario.
But
it doesn't happen in
this
minimal run.
Yeah, well, maybe we can come back to it.
My worry is about the
time scale of the talk. I didn't hear it. It's bad. Maybe it's ruled out. Because I got a lot of questions. I went too slow.
I'm happy to have eternal inflation.
That's what
I
said. I can't. Yeah, we can continue another time or never.
Are you going to hear about stringier part tomorrow from you?
Yeah, I'm going to hear about tomorrow, actually. So if you were happy, I'd love to go through this all. So if they said we could take a break for tea and then come back. Or people could vote for having to summarize. Yeah, and of course, not everybody has to participate. So I don't know. Any feeling?
Pardon me, we can also take a pause and then who comes back.
Oh, so David suggested you should have concluded on someone. Yes,
that's jump the base from the tree and then
just say how we come to these opinions. But it's because the discussion is good, so
I don't think they conclude on so illuminating. This is the details of the description. About this
So there will be people coming back if we take a break.
I think people want to see it, but how about going to
just go to page 43 and those.
Go to the solutions for those.
And there's all Dante.
This is a course.
There's a whole paper.
I don't think the conclusion is, I don't think it's disappointed by the conclusion, I think. Maybe the tutu needs to escape. Conclusion. Small G, I don't know. It's just a lot, but this is kind of
To
do.
Anyway,
I would say this, but I think maybe this makes sense after what I showed. I discussed how the origin of the flatness of the potential can be related to a construction string theory and how you can try to make this more. I mean, I was highlighting some issues and some difficulties in doing that. It fits existing data if the model is exists. And then you have interesting phenomenology that we will discuss tomorrow. So I guess that.
So there are people who want to do more, right?